and mortars to fill the new emplacements. This work, however, was also unfinished, and the Lieutenant Governor, General Robert Boyd, had conceived the idea of launching upon it a sustained barrage of red-hot shot and incendiary bombs. Technically, this was a difficult operation, seldom attempted in land warfare, although it was quite popular at sea. The cannonballs took about 3 hours on a huge grill to heat to the required temperature, after which the process of loading them presented major problems. On the other hand, they were formidable in their effect, setting fire to wood the moment they touched it, and inflicting hideous wounds on any man unfortunate enough to be in their path. Beginning soon after midnight, this barrage continued for 9 relentless hours, with some 5,500 rounds fired at the rate of 10 a minute. The flames ran along the Spanish lines like fuses along a trail of powder. The Spaniards, taken by surprise and at first unaware of the heat of the cannonballs, were slow to act. But once started, they fought like tigers, tearing down the burning wood with their bare hands as the missiles continued to rain down around them. General Boyd, watching from the Grand Battery, could not withhold his admiration. Braver men, he wrote, were never seen. But personal courage could not conceal the disaster or the humiliation. In order to save what face he could, Crillon ordered an immediate reply in kind, a sustained bombardment from 5 new batteries to begin at daybreak the following morning. Almost as many shots were fired on the 9th as on the 8th. The official count registered 5,403. But the balls were cold, and the Rock of Gibraltar was a very different proposition from the low, sandy isthmus. The bombardment continued throughout the following day, both from the shore batteries and from Admiral Moreno's ships, but little serious harm was done. Then, at 8 on the morning of the 12th, the lookouts reported the sails of a large fleet approaching from the west, and hearts rose. Had relief from England come in the nick of time? It had not. The sails were those of an immense French and Spanish armament, including 47 ships of the line alone, flying the flags of no less than 10 admirals. With its arrival, the defenders of the Rock found ranged against them an army of nearly 40,000, and with 200 pieces of heavy artillery. Their own relief fleet would now be useless, even if it were to arrive. Hopelessly outnumbered, it would have no hope of entering the harbor. Many of the defenders must by now have been feeling something very like despair. They might have been rather more cheerful had they had any idea of the bickering and growing confusion in the enemy camp. Crillon was urging an immediate attack. His honor was at stake. Autumn was approaching. The delays and postponements had gone on long enough. D'Arcon was protesting that his flotantes were not yet ready. No markers had been placed to guide them to their positions. No soundings had been taken of possible shoals or sandbanks. No anchors had been sunk to allow the vessels to be warped back if necessary. Caught between the two of them, Moreno felt frustrated and ignored, and sulked. It was, however, Crillon who prevailed. Shortly before 7 on the morning of 13 September, the first 3 of the 10 flotantes moved off to their allotted stations along the western shore. Moreno flew his flag on the 24-gun Pastora. A furious D'Arcon, knowing that they were all headed straight for a sandbank, had been obliged to board the next largest, the 23-gun Telepiedra, commanded by Don Juan Mendoza, Prince of Nassau. The 7 other captains, whether their vessels were ready or not, followed soon afterwards. 3 hours later, all 10 were drawn up, broadside on, some 800 yards offshore, covering the 1,000 yards between the Old Mole in the north and the South Bastion. The battle began. Late that night, Samuel Ansel, quartermaster of the 58th, wrote to his brother, "Tired and fatigued, I set down to let you know that the battle is our own, and that we have set the enemy's ships on fire. When they came on at 9 o'clock this morning, they proceeded successively to their different stations. and as they moored, began to fire with the utmost vivacity. At the same time, we began a discharge of cold shot upon them, but to our great astonishment, we found they rebounded from their sides and roofs. Even 13-inch shell would not penetrate one. However, we were not much disheartened. Although we had several killed, but with all possible speed, we kindled fires in our furnaces and put in our pills of 32 pounds weight to roast. If you could have peeped over the rock and viewed our several employees, you could not have forbore smiling. Some stationed to work the guns, like Ethiopians, black by rubbing their faces with their hands, dirtied with powder. The sons of Vulcan were blowing and sweating, while others were allotted to carry the blazing balls on an iron instrument made for that purpose. But as these did not afford a sufficient supply for the batteries, wheelbarrows were procured, filled with sand, and half a dozen shot thrown into each. The fire was returned on our part without intermission, and equally maintained by the foe. But the continual discharge of red-hot balls, kept up by us, was such as rendered all the precautions taken by the enemy in the construction of the flotantes of no effect, for the balls lodging in their sides, in length of time spread the fire throughout. This we found to be the case repeatedly during the day, though the foe frequently kept it under, but a continuance of the same inconvenience rendered it impossible at last to work their guns. Just as the close of daylight, we observed one of the largest to be on fire in several places, and soon after another in the same condition. This gave the troops additional courage, and the fire was redoubled upon the remaining 8. 1 o'clock in the morning, 14 September. The floating batteries have ceased firing, and one of them just broke out in flames. The hands on board them are throwing rockets as signals for assistance. A report is now received of an officer and 11 men were drove on shore upon a piece of timber, being part of a floating castle that was sunk by a shell from the garrison, as she was steering to cooperate with the flotantes. What had happened? First of all, we had seen that there had been no firm leadership, only a trio of squabbling prima donnas. Second, and this was to some extent a consequence of the first, the flotantes had been abandoned by the combined fleet. They had never been intended to operate alone. The original plan had called for 30 gunboats and 30 mortar boats to take up positions between them and on their flanks, from which to maintain a steady barrage against the shore batteries. Had they done so, they might well have affected the whole course of the battle. But of those boats there had been no sign. For reasons of his own, the Admiral, Don Luis de Cordoba, had refused to move. Third, the Chevalier d'Arson had overestimated the strength of his creations. In submersibles they may have been, in combustibles they were not. The very thickness of their defenses meant that a red-hot cannonball could penetrate deep into the cladding, there to smolder undetected and eventually ignite the timber around it. What was to be done? For the Spanish, the day had been a disaster, and that evening, at Crillon's headquarters, there was consternation. The first concern was for the flotantes, which still had some 5,000 men aboard. In two of them, including the Tagliapiedra, the worst hit, there were quite serious fires, but their powder had been dumped and they were unlikely to explode. On the other hand, their masts and rigging had been shot away and they were immobile. If somehow they could be towed to safety, they might still be saved. But how could this be done? And did Crillon want it done anyway? He had always hated the things, and while they remained unburned and unsunk, d'Orson could claim a certain measure of success. There was also the possibility that the British would take them as prizes. Far better that they should be destroyed, but first they would have to be evacuated. At about 10:30 that night, the general set off with the Prince of Nassau, who had abandoned the Tagliapiedra immediately after the outbreak of fire, to ask de Cordoba to send his frigates to take off the crews. But the old admiral refused outright. he could not expose his ships to enemy fire for such a purpose. Only his small boats would be available. The first of these reached the 10 huge hulks around midnight, carrying orders to each of the 10 captains to fire his vessel before abandoning it. There followed scenes of nightmare confusion. The exhausted men who had kept their heads and fought bravely under heavy bombardment for over 12 hours now panicked in their anxiety to escape. Some of the boats were so overloaded that they sank. Others were destroyed by the shore batteries even before they could take on their complement. It soon became clear that those remaining possessed nowhere near the capacity required and would need to make two or more journeys to the shore. But by now the captains had obeyed their orders and all 10 vessels were in flames. In each there were men who had failed to get away and had no choice but to leap over the side. It was better to drown than to burn. At daybreak on Saturday, 14 September, Mr. Ansell continued his letter. Our bay appears a scene of horror and conflagration. The foe are bewailing their perilous situation, whilst our gunboats are busily employed in saving the unhappy victims from surrounding flames and threatening death, although the enemy from their land batteries inhumanly discharged their ordnance upon our tars to prevent their affording them relief. But never was bravery more conspicuous, notwithstanding the imminent dangers which were to be apprehended from so daring an enterprise. Yet our boats rode alongside of the floating batteries, though the flames rushed out of their portholes and dragged the sufferers from their desperate state. The contempt paid by the British tars on the enemy's fire of round and grape shot and shells will ever do honor to Old England. 7 o'clock. The enemy's ships are blowing up one after another half full of men, and our boats, having stayed as long as possible, they are now returning with a body of prisoners. 10 o'clock. The floating batteries have not all exploded. One of them has almost burnt to the water's edge, the crew having thrown the powder overboard. The enemy's land batteries maintain their cannonade upon the garrison, while on the opposite shore confusion and consternation visibly appears. The nobles and grandees, who had assembled to view the capture of the place, are now withdrawing from the Spanish camp to carry the direful news to Philip's court. It must be galling vexation to our foes to behold their royal standard displayed on our South Parade, where it is tied to a gun and reversed. The grand attack had failed, but the Rock was not yet out of danger. The combined fleet still lay out in the bay, and armies of France and Spain were still encamped on the isthmus, where the bombardment had resumed as if nothing had happened. But there was now a degree of coming and going between the two sides under flags of truce, and on 6 October prisoners were exchanged. It was from one of these that the defenders learned that the relief fleet under Admiral Lord Howe was on its way at last. Howe had a hard time bringing his ships into Gibraltar. The equinoctial gales were doing their worst, and the fleet was blown right out into the Mediterranean. The enemy in hot pursuit, but somehow battle was avoided, and eventually every British vessel came safely into port. From that moment, the French and Spanish forces began gradually to disappear. Sporadic firing continued, but no one's heart seemed really to be in it. Gibraltar, everyone knew, would not be taken by storm. If ever it were to be surrendered to Spain, it would be by peaceful agreement and not by force. Preliminary negotiations began on 20 October. They were long and complicated and continued until just before Christmas. In the early stages, Britain showed herself perfectly prepared to give up Gibraltar for the right price. She would naturally expect the return of Menorca and the two Floridas, and several of the Caribbean islands as well. At the opening of Parliament on 5 December, however, Charles James Fox turned to the subject in the course of his reply to the King's speech. Gibraltar, he declared, has been of infinite use to this country by the diversion of so considerable a part of the force of our enemies, which employed elsewhere might have greatly annoyed us. The parliamentary report of his speech continues. The fortress of Gibraltar was to be ranked among the most important possessions of this country. It was that which gave us respect in the eyes of nations. Give up to Spain the fortress of Gibraltar, and the Mediterranean becomes to them a pool in which they can navigate at pleasure, and act without control or check. Deprive yourselves of this station, and the states of Europe that border the Mediterranean will no longer look to you for the maintenance of the free navigation of that sea, and having it no longer in your power to be useful, you cannot expect alliances. He was enthusiastically applauded, and it was largely thanks to his words that the government decided to hold on to the rock at all costs. Instead, the Spaniards were offered Menorca and East and West Florida, which, with some reluctance, they accepted. King George III was unhappier still. At the conclusion of the talks on 19 December, he wrote to his principal Secretary of State, Lord Grantham, "I should have liked Menorca and the two Floridas and Guadeloupe better than this proud fortress, in my opinion, source of another war, or at least of a constant lurking enmity." They were wise words. A few fertile islands would have been of infinitely more use to his kingdom than a barren rock. But it was not only Parliament that remained adamant. There can be little doubt that the British people felt the same way. They had just lost their American colonies. They had no intentions of giving up their only foothold in Europe, the symbol not only of their naval supremacy in the Mediterranean, but also, in the past 4 years, of endurance, fortitude, and courage. Chapter 21. The Young Napoleon. Napoleon Bonaparte was a Corsican, and thus a man of the Mediterranean. When he was born in 1769, Corsica had been French for only a few months. In its language, apart from a characteristic local accent, the culture, it remained wholly Italian. His father, Carlo Maria, had been one of Pasquale Paoli's most trusted lieutenants, and the boy grew up a fervent Corsican patriot, detesting the French as oppressors of his island. The family was, by Corsican standards, well-to-do and highly educated. Carlo Maria had strong literary inclinations, though these had not stopped him taking to the hills with Paoli for the long guerrilla war against the French. It was only after their final victory that he accepted the inevitable. The Bonapartes were not noble. Corsican nobility was a contradiction in terms. But they were landowners with a few small and scattered agricultural estates, and somehow Carlo Maria managed to scrape together the 4 heraldic quarterings which enabled his son to qualify at the age of 9 for a free primary education in a so-called military college. It was in fact run by a monastic order at Brion. Despised by his fellows for what they considered his humble birth, Corsican origins, and still heavily accented French, Napoleon not surprisingly became surly and withdrawn, given to occasional outbursts of violent temper. But he was a good scholar and a hard worker, and his brilliance in mathematics earned him in October 1784 a place at the National École Militaire in Paris. Even here he made no secret of his Corsican patriotism, lashing out with his fists or any weapon that came to hand against all who mocked him. But he worked harder than ever, and in September 1785, when still only 16, he passed out as an officer. He was sent first to the auxiliary training school at Valence, and then in 1788 to Auxonne in Burgundy. It was in Auxonne that he heard the news that was to transform his life. On 14 July 1789, the Bastille had fallen. France was in revolution. A month later, his regiment mutinied. As an instinctive hater of the Ancien Régime, Napoleon flung himself with enthusiasm into the revolutionary cause. He considered going straight to Paris, but in view of the general chaos in the capital, he decided instead to return temporarily to his home, where he was confident of his ability to shape events. His father had died, aged only 38, in 1784. Back in Corsica, despite the presence of his elder brother, Joseph, Napoleon now effectively made himself head of his family, advancing its interests in true Corsican style in any way he could. Before long, his influence extended well beyond family limits. It was he who drafted and was the first to sign a letter to the National Assembly in Paris, demanding that action be taken against the royalists who were still in charge of the island, a letter which seems to have been largely responsible for the Assembly's decision shortly afterwards to declare Corsica an integral part of the French state. He remained there throughout 1790, during which time Republican-dominated municipalities were elected in Ajaccio and the other principal towns, and when the Ajaccio Jacobin Club was established in January 1791, he became a founder member. In October, after a flagrantly dishonest election, he acquired command of the local volunteer militia. Sadly, however, he and his family fell out with the returned Paoli, who, while still striving for Corsican independence, was now de facto ruler of the island under the French, and had no patience with the revolutionary adventurers which he now conceived the Bonapartes to be. He was certainly right where Napoleon was concerned. Matters came to a head when the bumptious young officer proposed that his battalion of militia should replace the French garrison in the Ajaccio citadel. Paoli, outraged, refused to consider the idea, whereupon Napoleon launched an attack on the fortress on his own initiative. The fighting went on for 3 days, during which several men were killed. Then French reinforcements arrived and the besiegers were forced to retire. A report was sent to the Ministry of War in Paris, where Napoleon had already been recorded as having seriously overstayed his leave. If he wished to continue his military career, he would have to return and explain himself. By the end of May 1792, he was back in Paris. His reception at the military was warmer than he might have expected. The authorities were inclined to accept the various specious documents which he had brought from Corsica to explain his long absence. They had little choice. France was now at war and needed every man she could get. Since the outbreak of the Revolution, vast numbers of royalist officers had left the army in disgust, and its present depleted strength, particularly in the cavalry and the artillery, was causing grave concern. Of the 56 officers of Napoleon's own class, only 6 now remained. He, too, had been given up for lost, and now that the prodigal son had returned, the authorities had no intention of losing him again. The incident of the Ajaccio citadel was conveniently forgotten. He was restored to duty and promoted to captain. He made one more visit to Corsica. How he was permitted to take such a vast amount of leave has never been properly explained, especially since he had shown himself apt to exceed his allowance by several months, this time ostensibly to escort his sister, Mariana, back from the Royal Convent School at Saint-Cyr, which circumstances had forced to close down. They sailed from Marseille on 10 October. There was, predictably, no welcome from Paoli, ignoring him completely. Napoleon at once reinstated himself as lieutenant colonel of the volunteers, a rank which he had had to renounce on his return to the army in Paris. He then flung himself into a campaign to get his brother, Joseph, elected as a Corsican representative to the National Convention. But Corsica, he realized, was rapidly becoming a backwater. The revolution was no longer purely French. It was beginning to involve all Europe. In April 1792, despite the ruinous state of her finances, the depletion of her armed forces, and the chaos still prevailing throughout the country, France had declared war on Austria. 2 months later, she had done the same to Prussia and to Sardinia. One reason for these displays of naked aggression was, paradoxically enough, economic. In their present state, the only way the French armies could support themselves was by commandeering food and all their other needs from countries they invaded. Inevitably, however, revolutionary idealism played its part. The theory that under the shock of war all the peoples of Europe would rise up against their sovereigns and the spirit of the revolution would spread across the world. This, fortunately, failed to happen, but the initial success of the French armies certainly surpassed anything that could have been expected. An Austrian and Prussian invading army was turned back at Valmy in September. In October, a French army swept through the Rhineland, and a month later, another defeated the Austrians at Jemappes, occupied Brussels, and part of the Netherlands, while a fourth annexed Savoy. In February 1793, the convention declared war on England and, a month later, on Spain. Meanwhile, on 21 January, King Louis XVI had been beheaded on the guillotine in the Place de la Concorde before a cheering crowd. In all this stirring international drama, Napoleon Bonaparte's first role was one of almost laughable insignificance. Pasquale Paoli had received instructions from Paris to support an invasion of Sardinia. He was loath to do anything of the kind. Sardinia was Corsica's neighbor and natural ally. Her Piedmontese king had always been the friend of the Corsicans and of their cause, and had in the past often been generous with supplies and munitions. Still, orders were orders, and he gave his reluctant approval to an expedition by the Ajaccio battalion of the militia to seize and fortify the small island of La Maddalena, opposite Corsica off the North Sardinian coast. At the same time, however, he murmured to the expedition's leader, his nephew, Colonel Colonna Cesari, that it would be an excellent thing if the whole enterprise went up in smoke. The colonel took the hint. The battalion, hopelessly ill-equipped, sailed on 20 February and by the 24th was strategically placed to take the island. Captain Bonaparte, it need hardly be said, was of the company. From the start, he distinguished himself by his sheer professionalism, a quality in lamentably short supply among his fellows, and was confident that within a matter of hours, La Maddalena would be theirs. But Cesari identified a few grumbling sailors as an incipient mutiny and ordered the expedition's immediate return to Corsica. Napoleon objected fiercely, but was overruled. As a final humiliation, he was obliged to spike two of his guns and consign them to the sea. He addressed a letter of furious protest to Paoli, sending copies to the war minister in Paris as well as to the two Corsican representatives. Almost simultaneously, Paoli was the subject of another attack, this time by Napoleon's brother, Lucien Bonaparte. In a speech to the Jacobin Club at Toulon, Paoli declared Lucien was a traitor to France, whose only object was to deliver Corsica to the British. His words made a deep impression on the convention in Paris, who ordered the general's immediate arrest and sent three commissioners to investigate the charges. The commissioners found the island openly hostile. Paoli somehow was Corsica, and his people were prepared to fight for him, against the Bonapartes, against the convention, against anyone. To make matters worse, Lucien had stupidly sent his brother a letter in which he had written, "Paoli and Pazzo are to be arrested. Our fortune is made." The letter was intercepted by Paoli's police before the commissioners arrived, as a result of which the Bonapartes were condemned to perpetual execration and infamy, tantamount in the Corsican code of honor to a death sentence. To remain on the island was to risk assassination. Besides, Paoli had now begun an armed insurrection against the French, and the island was on the verge of civil war. For a moment, Napoleon considered a republican counter-rising of his own, with the object of taking over Ajaccio and turning the tables on his enemies. But it was too late. Clearly, there was no longer a future for him in Corsica. By the middle of June, he and his whole family were on their way to France. On his arrival, Napoleon rejoined the army and, finding himself in Nice at the beginning of September, made contact with his old friend and fellow Corsican, Jean-Christophe Salicetti. Salicetti was one of the two representatives of the people with the Revolution's Army of Italy. It was at that time besieging Toulon, which had been occupied a week or two before by royalists, British, and Spanish forces. It chanced that some days previously the French artillery commander had been badly wounded. A replacement was urgently needed, and Salicetti saw that Captain Bonaparte was just the man. Napoleon asked nothing better. From one moment to the next, his Corsican patriotism was forgotten. Henceforth, he was a Frenchman indeed, such as there had never been before. The state of the army, which he found drawn up before Toulon, was enough to make any trained officer weep. Most of the old royalists had emigrated, to be replaced by Republican volunteers with virtually no experience. The artillery consisted of a few broken-down old cannon and mortars, all of which were dangerously short of ammunition. On the credit side, there was only Napoleon himself, one of the few officers in the whole army of Italy who was a professional through and through. True, he was only a captain, but he had the powerful support of Salicetti, and his genius did the rest. One of his first actions was to send for more heavy guns from Nice and Marseille, which also provided 5,000 sandbags. Others he requisitioned from the forts at Martigues, Antibes, and Monaco. Wood he ordered from La Ciotta for the construction of proper platforms. At Olulle, he created a veritable arsenal and repair center with 80 blacksmiths, wheelwrights, and carpenters. From the outset, however, he found himself at loggerheads with his commander, the politically irreproachable but militarily idiotic General Cartou, whose only idea was to pour as much shot as possible into the town. Napoleon, on the other hand, seeing at once that the key to its continued resistance was the British fleet under Admiral Lord Hood, which lay just off the coast, pressed insistently for the capture of the little peninsula of Le Carre, from which red-hot cannonballs could be fired into Hood's ships. Finally, with the help of Salicetti, he obliged a grudging Cartou to give his permission. The first attempt on Le Carre failed, as Cartou, furious at having been overruled, had released only 400 men for the task. Thanks largely to the influence of the newly promoted Major Bonaparte, the hopeless old general was dismissed in October. His successor, General Jacques-François Dugommier, who had joined the army at 13 and was another thoroughgoing professional, immediately recognized his subordinate's genius and backed him to the hilt. The result was a full-scale assault on Fort Mulgrave, recently constructed by the British on the highest point of Le Carre. It took place on 17 December, in pouring rain, but was ultimately successful. In the early hours of the following morning, the British garrison evacuated the fort, while Hood's ships hastily weighed anchor and made for the open sea. On the following day, 19 December 1793, Toulon was French again. There was no doubt in anyone's mind to whom the credit belonged. Napoleon Bonaparte, who had had his horse shot under him and had been wounded by a bayonet in the thigh, had been proved right. Dugommier had already sent urgent and prophetic advice to the war minister in Paris. Récompensé avancé ses genoux, car selon état ingrat envers lui, il s'avancerait de le même. 3 days after the recovery of Toulon, he was appointed brigadier. He was just 24 years old. The long-delayed Corsican expedition took place in March 1795. It proved a fiasco. The British fleet was standing off the island in force and took so severe a toll of the French transports that they were unable to land. Once again, for a moment, Bonaparte's luck seemed to have deserted him. He returned to Paris, officially on sick leave, and awaited his next opportunity. It came on 5 October, 13 Vendémiaire, in the new Republican calendar, when he was ordered by Paul Barras, the commander-in-chief of the Army of the Interior, to put down a threatened royalist rising. With the memory of Corsican insurrections behind him, he did not hesitate. There would be no negotiation. He preferred to put his faith in heavy artillery. Fierce fighting broke out in the Tuileries, with heavy casualties on both sides. But the final issue was never in doubt. When the Directory was established a week or two later, Barras was nominated the first of its five members and Bonaparte appointed second in command of the Army of the Interior. In March 1796, when the Directory resolved to launch a new campaign against Austria through Italy, the slim, solemn young Corsican, bilingual in Italian, seemed the obvious choice to lead it. Shortly before his departure, in a civil ceremony held on 8 March 1796, Napoleon Bonaparte married one of the many widows of the guillotine, Josephine Dubonnet, a cast-off mistress of his friend Barras. Both lied about their ages, the 26-year-old groom actually producing the birth certificate of his elder brother, Joseph. 2 days later, he bid his bride farewell and headed south to Nice, there to take up his new command. This was to be the beginning of his first prolonged campaign, which was also to prove one of his greatest. Its intention was to mop up northern Italy, then to advance through Tyrol to Austria, and finally to meet up with the Army of the Rhine, carrying the war into Bavaria. It started with an advance into Piedmont. Nobody, except possibly Bonaparte himself, could have foreseen the measure and speed of his success. Almost every day brought news of another victory. Towards the end of April, Piedmont was annexed to France. King Charles Emmanuel IV abdicated and, retiring to Sardinia, which remained under his authority. On 8 May, the French crossed the Po and, 2 days later, forced the narrow bridge over the Adda at Lodi. On the 15th, Bonaparte made his formal entry into Milan. His army was, of course, living off the conquered land, requisitioning food and accommodation as necessary. But for the members of the Directory, this was not enough. Their instructions were to levy huge contributions both from the Italian states and from the church, not just to support the troops, but to send back to Paris. And Napoleon obeyed them to the letter. The neutral Duke of Parma, to take but one example, was obliged to hand over 2 million French livres and 20 of his best pictures to be chosen personally by the commander-in-chief. Few of the major towns escaped having to give up their Raphaels, their Titians, and their Leonardos. Many of these found their way to the Louvre or other French museums, where they still hang today. With the occupation of Milan, all Lombardy was now in French hands, save only Mantua. But the Austrians fought back with such determination that by 13 November, we find Bonaparte confessing to the Directory, in a mixture of exhaustion and despair, his fears that all Italy might soon be lost. Only in early 1797 did his spirits begin to recover. On 14 January, he engaged the Austrians at Rivoli, a village some 14 miles north of Verona between the Adige River and Lake Garda. He lost 2,200 men in the action, but his army inflicted 3,300 casualties on the enemy and took 7,000 prisoners. The following day, his general, Joubert, pursuing the fleeing Austrians, captured another 6,000. Meanwhile, Joubert's colleague, André Masséna, having marched southward all night, surrounded and captured a second Austrian column now isolated outside Mantua. From that day, Mantua was cut off without hope of relief. On 2 February, its starving garrison surrendered. Another 16,000 men and 1,500 guns were taken. At last, the way was clear for the invasion of Austria. True, it lay across the neutral territory of Venice, but that could not be helped. Such considerations were certainly not heeded by the Austrians, who were regularly crossing Venetian lands without let or hindrance. But if Venice did not protest, and her imperial sympathies were well known, Napoleon certainly did, taking every opportunity to browbeat and even threaten the local Venetian authorities. What they did not know was that his anger on these occasions was nothing but a simulated display, and that most of his threats were empty. His real purpose in his dealings with Venice at this time was not to enlist her aid or even to persuade her to take a more firmly neutral line. Rather, it was to frighten her, to put her in the wrong, to make her feel guilty and inadequate, to erode her pride, confidence, and self-respect to the point where her moral resistance would be reduced to the same level as her physical. Towards the end of March 1797, Napoleon led his army north over the Brixen Pass and into Tyrol. There he took the road to Vienna, leaving behind him only a few light garrisons in Bergamo and Brescia, with a rather more considerable force in Verona. He seems, however, to have had a secret purpose in mind, to stir up, throughout the Veneto, a revolutionary mood and to promote, wherever possible, open risings against Venice. The danger was, of course, that such risings might backfire against the French themselves, which indeed they did. On Easter Monday, 17 April, despite the strength of the garrison, the people of Verona came out in open insurrection, and in what came to be known as the Pasque Veronese, the Veronese Easter, massacred a considerable number of Frenchmen, both soldiers and civilians. Similar, though less serious outbreaks took place in Bergamo and Brescia, though these were principally directed against Venice. If, as is generally believed, all this was the work of French agents provocateurs, Napoleon would certainly have deemed the losses well worthwhile. They would have provided him with a further excuse for attacking the Venetian Republic, which he was by now determined to eradicate once and for all. When the news of these risings, and of many others which followed them, reached Venice, it caused something akin to panic. All the terra firma west of the Mincio River was effectively lost. The new frontier must be defended at any price. Armed militias raised among the local peasantry were the only hope. The local French commander, General Balland, was informed of Venice's intentions, it being emphasized to him that the measures proposed were to be purely defensive, directed not against the French, but against rebellious citizens of the Republic. What nobody seems to have foreseen was that these peasants, there were probably at least 10,000 of them, finding themselves for the first time with weapons in their hands, might not be over-conscientious in the manner of using them. They had no quarrel with the Italian rebels. They did, on the other hand, have plenty of outstanding scores to settle with the French, whose foraging parties regularly made free with their crops, their livestock, and, as often as not, their wives and daughters into the bargain. It was not long before the serious sniping began. Balland's reprisals were swift and savage, but they had no effect. By early April, every pretense of civility between French and Italians was gone. Napoleon, on the road to Vienna, had been kept fully informed of the worsening situation. Already on 10 April, he had dictated an ultimatum to the Doge to be delivered in person by his aide-de-camp, General Andoche Junot. Junot, arriving in Venice on the evening of Good Friday, the 14th, and demanded an audience with the Doge early the following morning. The reply was polite but firm. Holy Saturday was a day traditionally set aside for religious observances, and neither then nor on Easter Sunday itself could any government business be transacted. The Doge and his full collegio would, however, be happy to receive the general early on Monday morning. But Junot was not interested in religious observations and said so. His orders were to see the Doge within 24 hours, and he intended to obey them. If he were not accorded an audience within that time, he would leave and Venice would have to take the consequences. They would not, he suggested, be pleasant. Thus, when the Collegio reluctantly received him early on the Saturday morning, its dignity was already bruised. Ignoring the seat to which he was shown, on the Doge's right hand, the general remained standing. Then, without preliminary, he pulled Bonaparte's letter from his pocket and began to read. Judenberg, 20, Germinal, year 5. All the mainland of the Most Serene Republic is in arms. On every side, the rallying cry of the peasants whom you have armed is death to the French. They have already claimed as their victims several hundred soldiers of the Army of Italy. In vain do you try to shuffle off responsibility for the militias that you have brought into being. Do you think that just because I am in the heart of Germany, I am powerless to ensure respect for the foremost people of the universe? Do you expect the legions of Italy to tolerate the massacres that you have stirred up? The blood of my brothers in arms shall be avenged, and there is not one French battalion that, if charged with such a duty, would not feel the doubling of its courage, the trebling of its powers. The Venetian Senate has answered the generosity we have always shown with the blackest perfidy. Is it to be war or peace? If you do not take immediate measures to disperse these militias, if you do not arrest and deliver up to me those responsible for the recent murders, war is declared. The Turk is not at your gates. No enemy threatens you. You have deliberately fabricated pretexts in order to pretend to justify a rally of the people against my army. It shall be dissolved within 24 hours. We are no longer in the reign of Charles VIII. If, against the clearly stated wishes of the French government, you impel me to wage war, do not think that the French soldiers will follow the example of your own militias, ravaging the countryside of the innocent and unfortunate inhabitants of the terra firma. I shall protect these people, and the day will come when they shall bless the crimes that obliged the army of France to deliver them from your tyranny. Bonaparte. In the shocked silence that followed, Junot flung the letter on the table in front of them, turned on his heel, and strode from the room. Napoleon, meanwhile, continued his march. His manner with his men was, as always, cheerful and confident. In his heart, however, there must have been a growing anxiety on two counts. The first was strategic. His army was now poorly supplied, dangerously strung out in narrow mountain valleys, where there was little hope of forage, let alone pillage, with a hostile population around it and a formidable Austrian army awaiting it in front. The second, to him, was more serious still. His army formed only one prong of the French attack. There was also the Army of the Rhine, commanded by his brilliant young contemporary and chief rival, Lazare Hoche, which was now advancing eastwards through Germany at terrifying speed and threatening to reach Vienna before him. This was a possibility that he refused to contemplate. He and no one else must be the conqueror of the Habsburg Empire. His whole future career depended on it. He could not allow Hoche to steal his triumph. He was wrestling with these two problems when suddenly, and to him almost miraculously, the imperial government panicked and sued for an armistice. It must have been difficult to conceal his delight. His signature on such a document would stop Hoche in his tracks. Thus it came about that on 18 April 1797, at the castle of Eckenwald, just outside Leoben, a provisional peace was signed between Napoleon Bonaparte, acting in the name of the French Directory, although in fact he had never bothered to consult it, and the Austrian Empire. By its terms, details of which remained secret until they were confirmed 6 months later at Campo Formio, Austria was to renounce all claims to Belgium and to Lombardy, in return for which she would receive Istria, Dalmatia, and all the Venetian terra firma bounded by the Oglio and the Po and the Adriatic. Venice was to be compensated, most inadequately, by the formerly papal territories of Romagna, Ferrara, and Bologna. Bonaparte, it need hardly be said, had no conceivable right to dispose in such a way of the territory of neutral states. He would probably have argued that Venice was a neutral state no longer. Still, there was no escaping the fact that the laws of international diplomacy did not look kindly on arbitrary statements of this kind. However hollow Venice's professed neutrality might be, she would still have to be shaken out of it. And if, during the process, she could be made to appear in an unfavorable or even aggressive light, so much the better. Now, thanks to the complete demoralization of her government, she offered Bonaparte a perfect opportunity. We can have nothing but sympathy for Francesco Donna and Lunardo Giustinian, The two Venetian envoys sent off to Bonaparte with the reply to his letter and instructions to placate him as best they could. Even the physical aspect of their task was disagreeable enough. Napoleon was famous for the speed at which he traveled, and for the two middle-aged Venetians, those grueling days and nights spent trying to catch up with him, the endless jolting over some of the worst mountain roads in Europe, only occasionally interrupted by a few hours' rest snatched at some verminous and foul-smelling inn, must have been a nightmare. Nor can their spirits have been improved by the prospect of the stormy scenes that they knew lay ahead of them when they finally ran their quarry to earth. And even that was not all. In every town and village at which they stopped, the same rumors besieged their ears. France had made peace with Austria, and on the altar of that peace, Venice was to be sacrificed. The pursuit lasted over a week. It was not until 21 April at Graz that the two exhausted deputies finally drew up before the French camp. Bonaparte received them courteously enough and listened in silence to their protestations of friendship. Then suddenly his mood changed. Striding back and forth across the room, he launched into a searing diatribe against Venice, her government, and her people, accusing them of perfidy, hypocrisy, incompetence, injustice, medieval barbarities, and most serious of all in his eyes, hostility to himself and to France. He demanded the immediate release of all political prisoners, threatening, if this were not done, to break open the prisons himself. What, he continued, of all the Frenchmen whom the Venetians had murdered? His soldiers were determined to have their revenge, and he would not deny it to them. Any government unable to restrain its own subjects was an imbecile government and had no right to survive. He ended with those terrible words that were soon to echo in the hearts of every Venetian. Io sarò un Attila per lo Stato vinto. I shall be an Attila to the state of Venice. When the two envoys returned to Venice with their report, Doge Lodovico Manin and his colleagues saw that the Republic was doomed. War was imminent. Further negotiation was impossible. The terra firma was as good as lost. The only hope of saving the city itself from destruction lay in capitulation to the conqueror's demands, and these demands were terrible indeed. Nothing less than the abdication of the entire government and the abandonment of a constitution that had lasted more than 1,000 years, the suicide, in fact, of the state. On Friday, 12 May, 1797, the Great Council of Venice met for the last time, many of its members having already fled the city. It fell short by 63 of its constitutional quorum of 600, but the time for such niceties was past. The Doge was just completing his opening speech when the sound of firing was heard outside the palace. At once, all was in confusion. To those present, such sounds could mean one thing only. The popular uprising that they had so long dreaded had begun. Their only hope of survival was to escape from the palace while there was still time. Within minutes, the true source of the firing had been established. Some of the Dalmatian troops who were being removed from Venice on Bonaparte's orders had symbolically discharged their muskets into the air as a parting salute to the city. But the panic had begun. Reassurances were useless. Leaving their all too distinctive robes of office behind them, the remaining legislators of the Venetian Republic slipped discreetly out of the palace by the side entrances. The Serenissima was no more. Lodovico Manin himself made no attempt to flee. In the sudden stillness that followed the breakup of the meeting, he slowly gathered up his papers and withdrew to his private apartments. There he removed his corno, that curiously shaped cap which was the principal symbol of his office, and handed it to his valet. "Take this," he said. "I shall not be needing it again." From the inauguration of the first Doge in 726 to the resignation of the last in 1797, the Venetian Republic had lasted 1,071 years, only half a century less than the Empire of Byzantium. For much of that time, Venice had been the acknowledged mistress of the Mediterranean, politically, constitutionally, commercially, artistically, and architecturally, a wonder of the world. How pleasant it would be to record a less ignominious end, with her people showing, as their republic began to totter, some spark of that endurance and courage that they had shown often enough in defending their colonies against the Turks, or that their own grandchildren were to show against the Austrians half a century later. One would not have asked for, and certainly not have expected, a heroic resistance such as had been seen on the walls of Constantinople in 1453, merely a flash of the old Venetian spirit which would have allowed the Serenissima to pass into history with some semblance of honor. But even that was lacking. The last tragedy of Venice was not her death. It was the manner in which she died. Thus it was that when the Treaty of Campo Formio was signed on 17 October, Austria received even more than she had expected at Lurban. Not just the Venetian terra firma, but the city itself. Napoleon Bonaparte, however, was well pleased. He had always believed, probably rightly, that he could master Italy so long as it remained divided. Already in December 1796, he had formed his Cispadane Republic out of the merger of the duchies of Reggio and Modena, and the papal states of Bologna and Ferrara. The following June, he had established his Ligurian Republic, with its capital in Genoa, and in July, his Cisalpine Republic, based in Milan. As for Venice, he himself had never set foot there and had no desire to. He saw it, quite erroneously, in his mind's eye, as a brutally repressive police state, its dungeons bursting with political prisoners. Meanwhile, there was peace all over continental Europe. Only England remained an enemy. It was England now that must be invaded and destroyed. The Directory agreed, appointing Bonaparte commander-in-chief of the Army of England. But after the best part of a year's consideration, he reluctantly decided against the project. The expense would be too great, the necessary manpower unavailable. Above all, the French Navy was in a deplorable state. No match for the British, and with no commander who could hold a candle to Hood, Rodney, or St. Vincent, still less to Nelson. The alternative was Egypt. As early as July 1797, the foreign minister Charles Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord had proposed an Egyptian expedition, and 7 months later had produced a long memorandum on the subject. Inevitably, this contained a section deploring the cruelty of the local beys and pressing the necessity of delivering the Egyptian people from the oppression that it had so long endured. More worthy of attention was the suggestion that, with an army of 20 to 25,000, which would land at Alexandria and occupy Cairo, a further expedition could be launched against India, possibly through a hastily dug Suez Canal. On 2 March 1798, the Directory gave its formal approval. Not only would the proposal keep the army employed and their terrifying young general at a safe distance from Paris, it also offered an opportunity to take over the British role in India, while providing France with an important new colony in the eastern Mediterranean. Finally, if a little more problematically, it would achieve a major division of English sea power to the east, which might make the delayed invasion possible after all. Napoleon, it need hardly be said, accepted the command with enthusiasm. Since his childhood, he had been fascinated by the Orient, and he was determined that the expedition should have objectives other than the purely political and military. To this end, he recruited no less than 167 savants to accompany it, including scientists, mathematicians, astronomers, engineers, architects, painters, and draftsmen. Egypt had preserved her ancient mysteries for too long. She was a fruit more than ready for the plucking. The country had been effectively under the Mamelukes since 1250. In 1517, it had been conquered by the Turks and absorbed into the Ottoman Empire, part of which, technically, it still remained. By the middle of the 17th century, however, the Mamluk beys were once again in control. A French invasion would doubtless evoke an indignant protest from the Sultan in Constantinople, but his empire, though not yet known as the sick man of Europe, was a decadent and demoralized shadow of its former self and unlikely to represent much of a threat. Unfortunately, there were other risks a good deal more serious. The 300 French transport ships were poorly armed, their crews practically untrained. True, they had a naval escort of 27 ships of the line and frigates, but Nelson was already known to be cruising in the Mediterranean. Were he to intercept them, their chances of escape and those of the 31,000 men aboard them would be negligible. The fleet sailed in four separate divisions, the largest from Toulon, and the other three from Marseille, Genoa, and Civitavecchia, just north of Rome. Napoleon himself left Toulon.